Hello, everybody. Welcome back from lunch. I'm Marie Sierra from UNSW Art and Design, and I'm one of the researchers in the OLT grant that funded this project. And I was talking to Barb the other day about some of the beginnings of the project. She nominated at the opening remarks, it seems fitting to do this as we're approaching the close, of how this project started. And actually it had a few different sort of, not tap roots, but those long, soft, furry roots by which it started. Many years ago when I worked here at the VCA, Barb and I applied for a little grant. I think it was maybe $3,000 or $5,000 within the faculty of the VCA. And that was one of the ways that we found some time and space and funding to create some other applications, the ARC projects that she mentioned, and then eventually the OLT grant that was successful. So for PhD students in the audience or other students in the audience, or for early career researchers, I just wanted to remind you to keep faith that things start small and get bigger. And it's always important to just keep trying, even if you get knocked down for one grant, another opportunity might come along. And it may not be a grant, it may just be a network relationship or a conversation with somebody that gets things rolling in the end. I'm very happy to be able to introduce my good friend and colleague, Professor Steve Liu. Steve is the director of the University of Tasmania's Creative Exchange Institute. CXI, as it's known, the Creative Exchange Institute, responds to the big anthropocentric questions of the 21st century, and it does this through transdisciplinary research, as well as teaching and practice, and all of this at the crossroads of art, design, performance, environment, history, philosophy. And it does this also alongside social entrepreneurship, and that's an area that it's particularly working very fervently in now, and also community participation. Those are all big shapes. It's a very demanding role, I know. I worked at the University of Tasmania when that role was minted, and I think, in fact, we minted the name on one of our many commutes between Launceston and Hobart. You spend a lot of time driving when you work in Tasmania. And it's a really exciting initiative. We see similar initiatives at universities all around the country. But what Stephen particularly brings to this is his background as a creative practitioner, as an architect, as a philosopher, and someone who has a truly reflective practice. So we thought it most appropriate to ask him to reflect back on us over what we've experienced over the past 2 days, and also in response to James Rendell's keynote on our first day on Oren Katz this morning, because these are all colleagues and conversations that continue. So without further ado, I'll introduce Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Marie, and it's great to be here. All right. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the country that we meet in, its elders past and present, as well as its knowledges that we do inherit at the current time. Now, it's very interesting that this particular act of welcome is also a practice of ethics. And I reckon we heard from Estelle in the first day. I'm just trying to think whether... Can you hear the feedback?
Yeah. I'll see if I can mute that one.
I don't think I can. I've just tried it.
If I mute this one, maybe you won't echo. Or maybe we won't hear you. That's the other possibility.
Mm. No, that's muting.
The whole thing.
Hello? Nope. No. That's gone. Sorry? Yeah, the main mic.
Yeah, you plug it back on now.
No, mute it. It was on before.
Yeah,
nope, it's on.
You have to keep your finger on.
That's a performance in itself.
Would you like me to stand here? I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, maybe if I just not even use this and use that. Is it? Because Marie's got a finger on it. Hello?
It's because I got my finger on it. I think maybe take your other mic off.
Which one are you using?
That.
Do you use the lapel mic?
Yes.
It's on.
Yeah, it's on, but this one is on, is feedbacking.
Yeah, it's...
Yep, no worries. Okay.
You can hold that in your lap. Turn it around and it should be...
Sorry. Start again. Is that all right?
Yeah,
or is it still
right?
Okay, as I was saying, the notion of welcoming to country is actually an ethical practice in itself, and I can see a few ways in which we can kind of consider it, you know, an ethical practice. Firstly, by accepting a welcome that is of listening, that is of moving a choreography to space, and a taking of responsibility as a guest.
It's not actually designed to point out that way. If you point it out, you're just going to get feedback.
All right, okay.
To get back as far as possible. And I'll just switch the other one off, sorry. So I'm hearing that as well. Sorry, apologies.
Let's just go back to traditional and very conventional lecture mode. Forget about the performative.
We had it
Okay. So it's quite interesting to see the act of welcome as an ethical practice. By accepting a welcome, we are looking at practices of listening, practices of choreography, of moving through space, taking responsibility as a guest in terms of Indigenous country. But there is another ethical dimension sort of at play here, and I think Auntie Carolyn said it extremely well, that by vocalizing or by articulating, we are actually activating or reactivating a link to the past. And it is a kind of a connection to culture through this particular articulation. It becomes an ethics of almost an invocation. And this is where the past is kind of called up to the present, looking to the future. The interesting thing, the question here is, you know, do we recognize the past as we kind of bring it up? So for me here, bringing up the past is present in this particular plenary session. It is at the rear of the conference. I've been given a brief by Marie to say, can you, you know, sum up the conference and also make a response to the papers and as well as the keynotes that have been presented. And I must say, it's been a fantastic sort of experience. And I think that the research and the creative practice that have been presented really go, and I reiterate Jane's comment last night, that it goes a far way, a long way in terms of understanding the relationship between ethics and art and design. There is a sense of deja vu for me kind of standing up here. Interestingly, at the end of June in 2015, Jane, while she was chairing and holding a symposium on practicing ethics in the built environment, in built environment research at the Bartlett at UCL, asked me to also do a kind of plenary session, a kind of summing up of that symposium. And that particular symposium was also fantastic. So here I am again in terms, and I'm just feeling a sense of deja vu here of kind of almost repeating sort of myself, but relishing the idea of linking, I suppose, those two events, those two symposia. In that conference at the Bartlett, I came up after listening to all the papers. I came up, you know, through my kind of scribbled notes, was a welcome to country. And by the way, these images were, I had no images for the presentation today. I thought, oh, I'll try and make some images up, and all I had was my hotel room. So this is, all these images are harnessed from my hotel room at about 7:30 this morning. I think I'm giving hotel art a completely new dimension here. So I took copious quantities of notes during that symposia and came up with four summary points, what I call four notes to self in relation to ethics or philosophical ethics and the contribution that art and design can kind of make to those questions. And these four notes, and as I said before, is almost something that is brought up from the past. And if we look at what Freud says about kind of deja vu, it's really interesting, where we are almost seeking to accept something that kind of belongs to our ego. You know, with deja vu, we think, well, boy, this is really familiar. I've been here before. I can remember all of the details, but, you know, it can't be. There's an impossibility in the event because this event is sort of new. But what happens here is that the kind of past and present are brought in sort of conjunction, one side derealized from the other. So the sense of the notes that I've taken from that particular symposia coming to bear on the symposium, almost becoming the framework of a discussion, has been a very interesting exercise in itself. And to me, I saw this as a work of practicing ethics. Because what we're doing here, and I'll articulate this a little bit more, is putting in conjunction this realized past, this thought of future, thought of present, and the imagined future. And the relationship between past, present, and future, not in a kind of linear chronological way, occurring through the imbrication of these events, is a kind of fascinating dimension, and one of the fascinating dimensions of ethics. So if I looked closely at the four notes, and here are my notes from 2015, I was also interested to see what was happening around those notes, around sort of those events. And certainly my thinking and my thoughts during that time were influenced by other events around it. So other experiences, real or otherwise, or by accident around that particular symposium. And there's an uncanny sort of almost synchronicity, as Jung would put it, with the things that I was doing at that stage or acting out at that stage. There's an uncanny alignment with the points that were made by both Oron's and Jane's and even kind of Richard's keynotes. I just came from teaching a summer school in Paris called Ontology of the Prototype. And this is a consortium of sort of five universities teaching a summer school. And we were talking there about processual thinking, speculative materialism, and looking at what prototyping in design sort of meant philosophically. And we were, again, there was this issue with time and the relationship of futures to design, because design is a futural sort of exercise, and what actually happens when one makes and creates a prototype in the present, and what is its relationship to both the future and the past. I was also working at that stage on a part of a monograph, which hopefully will be finished writing by the end of this year, that I'm doing with Undine Selbach from Macquarie University. Undine is a performance artist, philosopher, and we're working on a monograph on the entomological imagination, in fact, the relationship between ethics and instincts. Here, a fantastic connection between ethics and our work on ecology. So if we look at the root word of between ethics and ecology, is the notion of ethos. Ethos defined as accustomed place or habitat. And the term kind of evolved to almost mean, you know, a character trait, a habit, and thus the relationship between habitat and habit. So ethology here, which is the study of behavior, whether of animals or non-human organisms or human beings themselves, the connection between ethology and ethics comes through sort of logos, or the articulation, or the word. So the formation of one's disposition to one's place in life, that proper living of life, that place of nature, of art, that expresses life, these are points that come in conjunction when we put the notion of ethics and kind of ethologies together. The third thing that I was kind of working on was the indigenous policy for the University of Tasmania. I'm part of the Aboriginal Policy Working Group for the sort of university. And we were looking here at access to higher education for Indigenous Australians, both within kind of Tasmania and sort of elsewhere, and specifically within the University of Tasmania. I hold, again, in a quite uncanny fashion, a chair of a steering committee of the Berent Review. The Berent Review is a review of higher education access by Indigenous Australians, and it's supposed to complement the Bradley Review of Higher Education some, you know, 6 or 7 years ago now. And I'm the chair of the steering committee of the professions looking at that particular access. And a lot of the discussions that we've had around that committee was how Indigenous knowledge is not just a corpus of knowledge that needs to be imparted within the higher education sector in order to increase participation, but in fact, Indigenous knowledge of land and culture really overturn the idea and the trademarks and the hallmarks of educational structures or pedagogy in the Western world. Here, the relationship, as I said, to land, country, and performance has, you know, much to kind of affect really epistemologies, the structuring of kind of knowledge itself, because it works through a much deeper kind of ontological level, right? So we move away almost from metaphysics, we move to a much more immanent, integrated, immanent, and performative sense of knowledge. Also, let's look at a little bit into the kind of future. It's very interesting when I flew back from that symposium at the Bartlett back to the University of Tasmania, where the divest movement by students was occurring. So my office is in the office area of the Vice Chancellor's office area, and the building basically got barricaded for about 2 weeks and with the divest movement. And so it's a fantastic group of students who were very clear in terms of their cause, really asking the university to rethink its investments in relation to fossil fuel companies and so forth. It was a very quiet protest, and in fact, they were camped outside for about 2 weeks, causing basically the people that worked in the building, including the Vice Chancellor himself, not being able to use the kind of front entrance, and had to, you know, we all had to use the kind of back stairway to actually sort of get through. What was fascinating there was the languages that were used, both by the students as well as by the university, on either side of the wall. So on the inside of the Vice Chancellor's area, there was, of course, you know, very difficult kind of conversations about how do we, you know, get out of this, and it, with our kind of reputations intact, both for the students as well as for the universities. On the outside, the students again were saying, you know, they put their claims very, very clearly, and the university was extremely supportive in terms of the occupation of that space, you know, feeding them, watering them. I think the thing got a bit difficult when, because they hadn't showered for about 10 days or 2 weeks, there was a, Yeah, so we couldn't actually have guests sort of come into the kind of vice chancellor's area. But both sides ended the kind of protests, the students ended the protests in a very amicable way, and there was a kind of promise of kind of further dialogues, which then subsequently sort of occurred. No one admitted defeat, but then what that whole protest has provoked was a whole series of kind of, you know, policy decisions and discussions that occur. And the last thing that, you know, I was kind of working on there was I was invited to do a work for a particular art exhibition called Navigating the Internal Landscape. It was a science and art kind of exhibition where artists were briefed to produce work that, inverted commas, interpreted cancer. So it's a health art project. And we were to look at how we might actually represent or interpret cancer through an artwork. I mean, I have a problem with art doing interpretive work. I have a problem with the relationship between science and art, where art just plays the handmaiden role to the sciences in terms of kind of illustration or description. So the work that I proposed in that for that exhibition was a performative banquet. So I do quite a bit of work with food, and you know, part of my practice is to kind of design recipes, actually cook the meal, and then sort of present the meal to sort of diners. So it's a full sort of banquet kind of experience, at least in this particular work it was. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the work as I go along, because what I want to do is actually to kind of use this work as the interlude between the points that I'm going to make about philosophical sort of ethics. So in a sense, to kind of step back and sort of look at the events and thinking that I was doing around that time, I mentioned the notion of synchronicity from Jung, and to me that's really quite fascinating, because here we have a whole series of events that are not connected in necessarily, firstly, they're not connected in time, but they're also not totally connected, you know, thematically or content-wise, and they certainly are at different epistemological registers, which means, you know, some of them in kind of policy work, others in artwork, and others in sort of teaching. But nevertheless, here we have looking at a whole kind of conjunction of assemblage of events as having not just extensive qualities of what we can identify of different types of knowledges and different practices, but having an intensive quality, kind of almost an imperceptible, you know, kind of relationality between those events. I mean, to Jung, synchronicity is two events that just happen to be simultaneous or closely you know, occurring in time, but there is enough in each of those events, enough similarity that allows a transfer of meaning between one to the other, where there's almost a leaping across of epistemological registers. Okay, they don't necessarily logically or even epistemologically, you know, fit together, but because of their serendipity, because of the accidental conjunction between those events, we can start to kind of look at this particular event as having an intensive and transversal character. And I think in many ways that's, to me, the shape of kind of ethical practice. We have rules, regulations, policies, we have codes. But on the other hand, we have participation and performances that move either that stem directly from those codes or move alongside them and in fact perhaps move in between. So there's a constant negotiation of these intensive qualities that cannot fully kind of be defined. And that's what I'm hoping to kind of show, I suppose, in terms of just quite a you know, a kind of nonchalant putting together of a whole series of kind of events. But yes, there is a connectivity there, a connectivity that we don't necessarily always recognize because we think they're just accidental or serendipitous. So where does this sort of thinking, this sort of practice fit within sort of philosophical ethics? And so a lot of, you know, what I'm going to do today for the, you know, the next half an hour or less would be kind of riffing, and let's see where this sort of takes us. So I'm going to use the 4 points that I, I'm just out of sequence here. There are 4 points that I'm going to use as a frame, as notes to self, in relation to philosophical ethics, and these are I suppose, you know, contributions that art, design, and performance sort of can make to the thinking. And I mentioned I'm going to intersperse these 4 points with the 4 courses in the performative banquet that I sort of created for the Navigating the Internal Landscape exhibition. Navigating the Internal Landscape, Academy Gallery, 20th of February to 15th of April, 2016. Having not felt like eating, but eaten, I sat down to eat tea. This is what was said at the back of the menu. The gut is the nervous system that extends well beyond the skull, and as it so travels through the body, it takes the psyche with it. Unquote. This is Elizabeth Wilson, Psychosomatics, page 47. The enteric nervous system, which handles digestion, develops profound psychological responses that cannot be explained simply by brain-based central nervous systems. Eating can become a performative mode of gut rethinking. Cancer as a condition of bodies being eaten and thinking away from cognitively based metaphysics towards a psychical engagement with the body, which even in its seemingly most automatic functions is so vital and complex. Ensemble, Food Design and Fabrication, Kamal Haggerty and Stephen Liu. Music, Sue Collins, violin, Michael Fortescue, double bass. Dining table and chairs, Simon Anker. Centerpiece, Stephen Liu. Thank you to the diners. For my mother who died with cancer in the middle of the show. The openness of second-order futurities. Now, what we're looking at about here, I mean, the range of papers that were presented, as I mentioned before, were really dealing with ethics and its procedures and practices in a very deep way. So much so that nearly all of the papers are looking at the limits of where ethics lie. So while they're opening up numerous fields, they're also defining in themselves and for themselves where the limits of ethical practice or ethical thinking would be. And the way in which I kind of think about it and the way that something that kind of has dawned on me is that really every work of ethic, every practice of ethics is actually the search for that limit. Otherwise, if we're looking at the kind of conventions and if we're looking at standard practices, that would be deep, you know, in the center of that particular practice, and really there wouldn't be very much of an ethical question if there is widespread acceptance of that practice. So practicing ethics is always practicing at the limits and conjuring up those limits for not just for ethics, but for practice themselves. So the first, I suppose, limit that I'd like to talk about is what I call the openness of second-order futurities. And this is here the limit of sheer scale in terms of what we have to deal with when we talk about ethics. When we deal with fossil fuels, when we deal with climate change, when we deal with transnational borders, or the poverty that is associated with war, we're looking at conditions here that really do not respect human-made sort of borders. So the ethical conditions are always ones that would transgress those ready-made borders, those conventional borders, and would cause us to question, I suppose, again, the leap between epistemologies that occur every time we bring up transgressions of borders. We can put into this mix the idea of the issues surrounding indigenous communities, intergenerational trauma. We've heard papers about that. If we look at the other end of the scale, if we look from the very large geographical, almost planetary end to the infinitesimal, the very, very small, when we start to kind of talk about, you know, viruses and bacteria, contagion, we look at the transgressions that actually occur within bodies, human or otherwise. And, you know, I'm kind of reflecting here again on Oren's work. We're looking at psychical boundaries. I don't really know where the limits are in Veronica and Sean's work and in telepathy. So there is certainly a moving towards the and testing, I suppose, the boundaries of how far and how big we can fathom an ethical project to be, or how small and how infinitesimal they can be. So these to me are already practices of ethics that are quite far from equilibrium. And what Isabel Stengers has said through her work with Ilya Prigioni in terms of the chemistry of far from equilibrium states is that they don't respect Newtonian physics. They play with sort of quantum mechanics. And we actually have our kind of rules and codes quite sort of eroded and mixed up when we start to deal with scales of that size or infinitesimal scales. Another point that can be made about this is, you know, what I call second order futures. So, you know, in design we're quite used to, you know, designing for a particular community or a place or an event, let's say, or a function, okay? So those are kind of first order futures where we can almost predict and we attempt to make design sort of predict, you know, what how it can actually be used and what use it can be to these kind of communities. But if we start to then think about what actually happens when, you know, in the future these designed objects, land in places and communities and publics, where their effects, although maybe now they're kind of obsolete, but their effects are something which are quite unpredictable. And therefore, you know, the notion of ethics here would have to grapple with the imperceptible of where, you know, what we have actually produced in the world and their implications for its connection and its relationship and, in fact, its impact on others that we have yet to define. How do we take responsibility for something like that? I've been having kind of conversations with Ginny Lee on nuclear threats. And if we look at what the South Australian government is attempting to do, again, is to, I suppose, make a repository for nuclear waste in the kind of middle of the desert. I mean, what we're looking here in terms of the kind of time frame is not just 10, 20 generations, but we're looking at thousands of generations of radioactive waste still being alive in the kind of landscape. So these are limits, you know, far from equilibrium sort of limits that, you know, we kind of have to deal with when we deal with ethics. Because I'm also quite conscious of time, so I'm just now going to move a little bit quicker through the points. So the and also I just noticed that my computer is about to die.
I've been texting people in the audience. I'll find some more plug in. You just keep going. I'll deal with that.
I'll
find the power. He's from Tassie. He should. I think they use the same there.
Is it there? All right. So the first course that I served was bouillabaisse chinois orabaisse gel, sushi rice panna cotta, and wakame foam served with umami sprinkles. The music was Madame Butterfly by Puccini. Two dishes she craved to eat were Chinese steamed whole snapper and California rolls. They defeated her in the end. Appetite is a primary victim of many cancer treatments. Eating is compromised by mouth dryness or loss of functionality of the tongue and larynx, organs that allow eating and drinking, speech and language through the regulation of breath. Food textures and composition need to be modified to facilitate mastication and swallowing. She realized that the beautiful memory of their married life, which she held all these years, is changed forever when he does not return. She cuts her throat in silence behind the screen. The second point I'd like to make is on the axiomatics of capital procedure and rights. Ethics has certainly become an industry. It's in many ways co-opted by sort of capitalism, because if we think about policy writing consultancies to risk management and mitigation, they are all, part of a kind of capitalist engine in many ways. So therein lies the context for our ethics kind of clearance form, not so much to kind of, look at the ethical implications of the work, but more so to protect the institution and their kind of researchers from risk. The other thing that I was also wanting to kind of talk about here is that this kind of possibility of self and the other through this industry is also part of the machine, unfortunately, because we've heard many papers kind of talk about how the subject is produced, through the processes of, through ethical processes or processes that are related to kind of ethical procedures. And so herein, the kind of relationship between self and other is part of this machinery, and the tensions and conflicts, in relation to ethical procedures, certainly are on one hand, if we kind of design them correctly, would be resistances to that, but if we, I suppose, use them uncritically, we would then be kind of subsumed within that engine. I mentioned in London, much to the horror of the of the people gathered there, and I said something like ethical practice has very much to learn from capitalism. And of course, capitalism that goes hand in hand with a neo kind of liberal economy. Because what I think is really interesting with capitalism is that it has a very uncanny knack, and it's very good at kicking its feet from under itself all the time, right? But then it does this for its own gain, because in every move that it makes, when it makes itself fail, but not fail completely, just fail enough to decode, you know, what is the existing situation, so that it can build a marketplace to recode it. Okay? And you can think about anything in terms of the commodities that we purchase and we consume. The decoding and the recoding is constant. There's always new versions of the iPhone in kind of many ways. So trying to find kind of new markets, you know, in terms of capitalism and consumerism, we can now kind of transfer that to kind of thinking about ethics. If ethics then becomes a practice of finding, almost finding axioms within the, you know, the kind of plethora of procedures that we actually have in front of us and that we use, and that if we can find these axioms and use them as what Bruno Latour calls mobile immutables, which means something that is put in the ray of or the flow of capital or the flow of kind of ethical thinking in order to diffract, you know, whether we diffract discourses or affects or data, because this diffraction becomes an opening up of possibilities within the actual procedures that that we are practicing. And so in that opening up, and because the subject-object relation is connected to the kind of, and is produced in these procedures, we then have then the possibility of redefining constantly who we are and basically who we welcome as the other in our midst. So if we connect this then to another Deleuzean notion of desiring production, where there is certainly work, and work is important. Labor is needs to be kind of valued. But the valuing of labor has always been related to the final result, the thing that is produced at the end, you know, the goods and the commodities. And in our case, you know, kind of policies and procedures in terms of ethics. Now, if we start to kind of revalue work in a different way, and thinking again about how we might practice ethics, if we don't concentrate on defining our processes for the end game, but in fact look at the kind of, you know, intensive nature of the work that we're doing, the imminent, you know, relations that actually sort of occur, and taking really, you know, seriously these particular kind of intensive qualities, we have produced work that cannot be co-opted by the neoliberal economy. So if we kind of think about, if we make something really visible, bright and shiny, capitalism will co-opt it very easily because it is identifiable, it is graspable, and therefore it's commodifiable. If we do work that produces material and it produces objects and events and conditions that are less co-optable, which means they don't quite fit the bill, but certainly with enough recognition so that, you know, we can actually take the next step. There are enough footholds there for us to take the next step. So Deleuze would call it this kind of absence in style, a sort of a asyntactic, agrammatical, you know, moment where language cannot define what it says, it can't signify completely, but it causes, you know, the event to move, to become, right? And maybe to kind of explode, because this is what desire, this is how we build desire. We build desire because we cannot fully close the loop, we can't fully satisfy, you know, with the bright new shiny thing because we don't quite have it there, right? But the processes are certainly gearing up towards producing that but never quite getting there. So desiring production to Deleuze is a kind of pure multiplicity and is an affirmation of the irreducible nature of any sort of kind of work and labor that we do. So the affirmation of difference without complete identity and the affirmation of difference as pure difference. So if we then focus in on the type of work and all the projects that have been presented in the conference here, we can see these particular economic flows, these particular informational flows, through various steps and kind of procedures. Information here doesn't have a kind of clean conduit that our labor transmits from sort of one thing or one end to another. Okay, what we have here is information kind of taking form. So it's information, where the shape that the information takes begets the next step that we make. Okay, it is the actual form of the information that actually gives us the possibility of the next shape, as opposed to having the shape already there and the information just kind of flowing in unheeded from one end to the other. Because if we have the smoother the flow of information, the smoother the striation, the easier in terms of the co-opting by capitalism. The second course is cigar smoked infused homemade ricotta with roasted beetroot pouring foam, served through a butcher arm, we wanted to do a robotic arm shaped beef bone, but we didn't quite get the robot to behave itself. And it's a sharing dish. The musical accompaniment is Pachelbel's Canon. The third limit that I'd like to kind of talk about is what I see as a kind of anthropocenic service to the coming other. And here we're talking about individuality, the individual, individuality, and the notion of individuation. Human rights is certainly, a kind of basic right in relation to the individual. And the protection of human rights would be a kind of paramount notion underlining sort of human rights, okay? And we've also heard that consent, informed consent, is also a basic human right. The issue here is that we've mentioned that the kind of process of ethics is always already defining the kind of individual, the subject, that's producing it. But to me, the way to kind of relook at this particular equation is to make the individual processual, which means, if we think about the individual as constantly kind of being produced in all of the work that we do, then we can call it individuation in the sense of a verb. So it's a kind of sort of process. So human rights then becomes the right to individuate, to become human, as opposed to having already the defined notion of the human being. So we're moving here from the right of the individual to the right of individuation. So the notion of becoming human here, is also defining not just the person, not just the organism, or not just the environment. We're looking at also the definition of cultures, society, the Internet of Things, if we want to kind of put it kind of in another way. So we have here a process by which ethics is always in play when we start to then produce names for these individuated entities. And the names are how we kind of define things, so where we draw the borders and where we draw the limits. And as Jacques Rancière says, naming is a practice. Misnaming becomes an ethical conundrum, because what we're always doing in many ways is correcting the names that have been provided to us or for us, and others correcting the names that we've provided for them. So this type of negotiation of in terms of kind of misnaming is kind of an actual work of kind of resistance that allows, again, to Rancière, what he calls the distribution of the sensible. So the distribution or redistribution of the way in which we can see and the way in which we can say, or what we can say. So the ethical practice then becomes the negotiation of wrong naming and the kind of battles that occur, you know, sort of between groups, which participates in a type of solidarity that is not fixed, but always partial, kind of always sort of in progress. And so if we kind of then look at this notion of the whole individual, we have another conundrum, because if we look, for example, at Lillian Bonney's work on mental and physical trauma associated with incarceration and intergenerational traumatic memory, if we look at Oren's work on kind of biological art, we realize that the notion of the whole individual doesn't always exist in terms of our practices, and that we can't really rely upon that in order to define sort of our sort of ethical practices. And if we take it further to non-human others, animals, and the environments, then we have the possibility here that there may be no reciprocity between the human being and the non kind of human other, because the notion of individuation is so very different between the two parties. Okay, so there's no reciprocity. We don't actually get the empathy, sympathy, especially when we start to talk about bacteria, or in my case, when I talk about insects. How do we know? When we deal with a dog, when we deal with the larger mammals, we can intuit a type of empathy and a sympathy back, a reciprocity back from the non-human other. But once we get into sort of other dimensions or other organisms, we find that kind of very difficult sort of to do. So this, I can kind of round up this point in terms of, Derrida's notion of hospitality, which is a welcome no matter who comes. And I think Jeremy Till kind of quoting, is that zero? Two, okay. Quoting Sam Mockby says, ethics is to help those that are not likely to help in return, and to do so even if no one is watching. The third course, three mouthfeels, everlasting gobstopper wrapped in edible silver, served with deep-fried sage. So the last condition that, and I'm going to talk about it very, very quickly, is the performative ethico-aesthetics responsiveness to kind of humanity. So here, if ethics are kind of based on clear perceptions, which is the evidence of the noble and what can be kind of proven, then and with means that the ethical procedures can be laid out and sort of repeated. But this particular condition comes to a limit, as we have seen, when we are faced with different modes of sensation and perception, different affects, which are not human-based kind of emotions, and certainly, the kind of condition of let's say, the psychic space or sort of the imagination. When Andrew Goodman was talking about the rocks feeling, right, of course we can... There's a kind of identifiable relationality that the rock has, but it's certainly not about the similar kind of sensations and perceptions that human beings would have. Telepathy, I mean, what actually goes on in that particular dimension between sort of two people or two things? Although it's a kind of materialization of thought, we really do not know the kind of nature of sensations and perceptions there. And so, you know, this type of condition, art, design, performance can really help, because what it holds within them would be the possibility of spatiality, of temporality and relationality. I mean, these are the creative arts, these are the disciplines that actually hold ontologically onto these sort of dimensions. And so I think the contribution here, and I don't have time to kind of elaborate, the contribution here of art, design, performance to ethical practice certainly lies in these registers dealing with the non-anthropocentric sensations and kind of perceptions. You know, it becomes almost a kind of cosmopoetic, you know, sort of approach to kind of ethical practice. And I'd like to end, I suppose, as a conclusion, to perhaps give a personal response to Jane and her keynote sort of address, because what I see as sort of an amazing, I suppose, ethical process happening across 2 years or so. I've witnessed all of, you know, all four of Jane's lectures, which are variations and extensions to the one that you've heard last night. I was there, you know, when the whole ethical conundrum started at UCL, and I was talking to her last night about, you know, the transformations that actually occurred in grappling with these ethical issues over the 2 years, transformation in terms of thinking, of how we can kind of think, of how Jane has needed to think ethically in kind of different ways as she went along. The changes in the policies and procedures, the different ones that she's used and the different ones that she had to kind of respond to, and when she's kind of negotiating or had to negotiate the institutional and moral context of certain practices that you know, she's concerned about. So in many ways, she's kind of changed her position aesthetically, but she's also changed herself in many ways. The transformation of self was very evident in bearing witness to all four kind of lectures. So herself, psychically, psychologically, has undergone that transformation, not to mention the kind of physical toll that these particular practices have taken. So in Jane's process, the self is unstable. Sorry, I'm not saying it's Jane's unstable. The self is unstable. It's kind of partial. The self is not just one, you know, in terms of the kind of transformation of self, because of the kind of relationality that is always there in every individuation, that we're always connected with the other that are around us, that whom we know, the other that we don't know who are coming, the self as the other who returns. So these relations are constantly there, constantly being kind of negotiated, and it is here, this kind of striving and perseverance, what Spinoza calls conatus, is the ethical kind of know-how that we should actually be kind of striving for. Ethics is not about good and evil, with a big G and a big E. Ethics is about knowing, you know, in our own kind of tacit way, what is good for us and what is bad for us. What is good for us is relations that kind of build our capacity to affect and be affected, again, Spinoza. What is bad for us is relations that diminish those capacities. So these particular, you know, strivings, these perseverances are, to me, you know, the very ontological basis for practice. Yes, and I think I've got one last statement to make about, you know, what about the bloody ethics clearance forms, which certainly has pervaded the conference. And I just have this to say, that in terms of kind of writing ethical codes, you know, these are not just codes of practice, codes that actually define practice, but they should be codes for practice, which means you write codes in order to open up practice, to open up spaces for novel practices to actually occur. Thank you.